Because we have limited time, I'm going to dispense with very many personal comments and get straight to the material that we have to look at tonight about an update in the work, the progress in the work in Brazil. It was about 2.5 years ago that we were here the last time. And so I want to take just a little bit of time to give kind of a review of the background that goes back through almost 20 years that we have been down there, and then spend more time focusing on the current status of the work, kind of giving an idea of progress over these last years. And at the very end, I want to make a few brief comments about some of the challenges that we face, plans as we look to the future in that work. Very quickly, some background information. Most of you have heard this other times we've been through here, or maybe from others who have been here. Brazil is a large country, larger in land area than the 48 contiguous United States, with about 200 million people living in that area. We moved there in August of 1993, so if we make it to August 10th of this year, that'll be 19 years that we've lived there. Our intention was to stay for 3 years, maybe five. We now have not only have our three children married Brazilians, but all seven of our grandchildren are Brazilian citizens and not U.S. citizens. Our children were young enough when we moved to Brazil that their children do not automatically qualify for U.S. citizenship. I think that qualifies as having established roots in Brazil. We live and work in São Paulo, which is down on the southeastern coast of the country, close to the coast. We're about an hour and a half from the actual coast. During the last years, and this will be a big part of what I look at tonight with you, we've given increasing attention to travel and work throughout the country, not just there in São Paulo where we live. And of course, as Brother Britno mentioned, there have been a number of other North Americans involved over the years in this work, various men who have lived there, some that he's mentioned that have connections with the congregation here, several others who have lived there and who make some trips back there. Currently, the only other North American preacher who would comfortably preach here who is working with us down in Brazil is Carl Ballard. Carl moved to Brazil when he was single, spent about 6.5 years there, during which time he found a wife, brought her to the United States along with a couple of children, lived in the States for a while, and then he repented and returned to Brazil. So he and his family are now about 1,500 miles or so north of us on the northeastern coast of the country. And as you'll see as we go through this tonight, the work of a number of Brazilians who have shown a great deal of dedication to the spread of the gospel. I believe that any work depends on nationals, and the work that's being done in Brazil very clearly depends on the nationals who are involved. I want to mention just a little bit about the sources of contacts, and I realize this is all in Portuguese here, but it's just one of the things that we use to try to get people to take a look at a website, try to draw them into that. But as far as contacts in general, I don't think that our situation is all that much different, although there may be some specifics a little different than it might be in other places. Most of the best contacts we have often come through personal contacts, and especially of new converts. I strongly encourage new converts in the first year or two after their conversion to take advantage of those opportunities, because generally within that time period, most of the best opportunities will start to dry up. They will have already talked to people, given an opportunity, and either those people will be interested or they won't. And after a couple of years, it'll be more difficult many times to reach those people. We've seen some people very effective at inviting others over to their homes to study, as was the case of Christina. Actually, this was before she was baptized the same night this picture was taken. First time we visited her city, as she had participated in studies in another state before that, and she wanted to invite some people over to study. I said, that'd be fine. So then she started unloading the plastic chairs and putting them out on the patio and getting ready for some 35 or 37 people who came that night. Vanderlei, the man standing up kind of toward the back in this picture. This was, if I'm not mistaken, the first trip I'd made to Manaus after his conversion. And I'll mention a little bit more about Vanderlei if there's time later on. But he also asked if he could invite some people over to his house for a study. He said, that'd be great. He said, well, I have to start at 9 o'clock at night because of the work schedules these folks have. No problem. Somebody says they want to invite some folks over for a Bible study. I figure 3, 4, half a dozen people. He had 41 people on his rooftop that night for a Bible study, starting at 9 o'clock at night. Some of those people were later converted. Many of them are no longer showing much interest, but Vanderlei continues to be very diligent in his work. Throughout our time in Brazil, we have used printed material. We continue to use that. Not everybody uses the internet, which I'll be talking about in a moment. And so continues to be an effective way to reach people and to reinforce the learning of those even who are using the internet. In the last several months, I've had opportunity to write a twice-weekly newspaper column. It's one column about that wide, the length of a tabloid-sized newspaper page. This because of a man who was converted last year in the southern part of the country who runs an auto repair shop and knows a lot of people in his city, including some of the editors of the local newspaper. So he pitched the idea to them. They agreed to that. They're not charging anything. And I now have this column twice a week entitled, What Does the Bible Say? That kind of gives me latitude to deal with just about anything and an opportunity to reach out to areas that we otherwise would have difficulty getting to. This newspaper goes to about 35 or 40 small towns in the northern part of the southernmost state of Brazil. Something like 12,000 or so newspapers get out to those small towns. By far, our biggest source of contacts in recent years have come through the internet. We have maintained a website. Carl Henneke was the one who had the idea for it and has done the work of maintaining it as far as the technical aspect of it since we started it back about 95 or 96, when hardly anybody knew what the internet was. Very few people were using the internet at that point. I remember being pleased after I don't know how many weeks to find out that 1,000 people had visited the website. These days, that takes about an hour and a half to happen. We're getting an average of 20,000 visits per day to this website over the last several months, up a little bit from a year or so ago, but it has turned out to be a tremendous source of contacts and opportunities. In about the last year and a half, we've also added to that using YouTube as far as the technology for it, but then embedding in our website videos that deal with a broad array of topics. Some of these are 3 or 4 minute messages just about a single verse or single idea. Others of them are sermons or Bible classes, 25 minutes in length. We've got about 85 or so of those messages on there so far that people can go to. And even if others pick these up to put them onto their websites, which happens frequently, we keep a little logo in each of these that stays visible throughout the video that brings them back to our website. It'd be possible to take that out, but it'd require somebody that knows a little bit about video editing, at least, to do that. And few of the people that pick it up will do that. With those videos, we're seeing now about 1,000 views a day on average, about 30,000 a month. And this, by the comments and the feedback we get from people, has turned out to be very effective in our teaching. The man I mentioned who was converted last year, who got the opportunity for the newspaper articles, when he first came across our website, he said he stayed up all night watching all the videos that were on there. The next morning, told his wife they had some things to talk about. Fortunately, they both showed the same interest. A few months later, both of them were baptized. That began a new church in the city of Erechim, in the northern part of Rio Grande do Sul. For a while, for several months, it was just the two of them, husband and wife. But a couple of months ago, they baptized another couple that they have been teaching there. So the church doubled in size that day. There are now four of them meeting together in that city. As I'm going to show in a few moments, we have the reality of people scattered all over the place trying to serve the Lord, many times in tiny churches, sometimes with just two people or five people. Sometimes there are even Christians who are isolated that don't know any others to worship with for maybe hundreds of miles from them. And so video conferences have been one of the ways to be able to try to serve better some of these people. There were a couple of women, Brazilian women, who live in Belgium, who were converted in the last couple of years. They contacted us through our website. We were able to put them in contact with brethren in Holland. Because of that contact and their conversion, they were then in a situation of worshiping with a congregation where they speak Dutch and English. These women are Brazilians. They speak Portuguese. One of them speaks some English. But we were able to work out an arrangement with the brethren there that during the women would participate in the worship service normally. But when it came time for the sermon, they would go off into another room and watch a sermon in Portuguese on live video conference while the others were hearing a sermon in Dutch. Not an ideal arrangement, but better than hearing something they couldn't understand at all. And I was real slow about getting involved in Facebook, but it has become an effective tool to try to tell people about Bible studies, as well as to encourage communication between brethren, especially some of these new converts who are very isolated from other places. As I mentioned, the last few years, I've been traveling a lot more than I used to. Pretty simple reason for that. My kids grew up. I felt the liberty to be away from home more than I did when I had young or teenage children at home. And so in the last several years, we've been working at constantly trying to perfect some approaches of public Bible studies offered throughout the country. We've done this now in every region of Brazil, in most states of Brazil, at least in the capital city of most of the states. There are only 26 states plus a federal district in Brazil, so that's a little easier than it might be to do the same thing here. We do these studies in neutral locations. By that I mean not in a place that's thought of as being a meeting place for the church, but in a schoolroom or a community center or a conference room of a hotel. Normally, what we are doing are study marathons. We've come to the conclusion this is the most effective use of limited resources. To instead of renting a place for 5 or 6 nights in a row and having the cost of lodging and so on to stay in a city for that long, we do 6 or 6.5 hours of study in a single day, where people will come and start. We'll start at 10 o'clock in the morning and go to 5 o'clock in the afternoon with an hour or sometimes less than an hour lunch break, or sometimes from 2 in the afternoon till 9 o'clock at night. And yes, most of the people that are there when we start are still there when we finish. The interest shown in these studies is always high, and there are very few people who will drop out in the middle of even a marathon of study like that. We always include opportunities for question and answer, which often turn into informal debates at the end of these classes. And those turn out to be some of the best opportunities. A couple of years ago, I had visited one city several times because we'd baptized 2 people in that city. We were hoping to find some other people with interest. And after being there several times, it hadn't happened until one time that on a particular night, on a Wednesday night, I did a study that dealt with what's necessary for salvation. When I got done with that, including an emphasis on the necessity of immersion in water for the forgiveness of our sins, there was a very well-mannered elderly Baptist gentleman who had participated in several studies already, usually made some very good comments. He stood up and he disagreed with everything I said. Argued with me about all of it. I let him state his case. I then responded. He again, very courteously, stated his case again, brought in some new arguments. So I replied one more time. Then I turned to the audience and said to them, you all are going to have to sort this out. We can't both be right, because what we are saying is clearly contradictory. Either we're both wrong or one of us is wrong, and you all are going to have to figure that out. I'd already seen so much interest on the part of some of the people present that I had agreed that after spending 3 days in another part of the state, that I was going to be coming back through there, and I'd have from about 8:30 on Sunday night until 4 o'clock on Monday morning free. I was between the bus ride and the plane ride. So they met me at the bus station, took me straight to a house where there were about 30 people waiting in a living room, and we studied together until pretty late that night. But before I left there, early in the morning, 14 of them had been immersed for the remission of their sins. Several of them were present the night that this Baptist gentleman debated with me in the question-answer session. Unfortunately, he did not choose to obey the gospel. But others who heard both sides of the argument were able to see the truth and make the choice. We advertise these studies, especially through our website, hand out a lot of flyers. The little church in Manaus of about 20 people that last year, those people alone were responsible for handing out more than 100,000 flyers, many of them in their own city, and some of them traveled to other states to help in studies we were doing there, kind of as an advanced team, handing out flyers in the days before the studies. As far as topics that we study and teach in these sessions, we've dealt with a little bit of everything over the years. The nature of God, the difference between the testaments, salvation, the church. Sometimes we've taken books and studied through books or done surveys of books in that 6-hour marathon. Last year, because I'd seen so many of the same questions coming up, the controversial issues that come up when you bring together a group of people who come from a number of different religious backgrounds, I decided to pull together the most common of those questions. Questions about the Holy Spirit, questions about salvation, questions about the qualification of pastors, about premillennialism, a number of different topics of that sort, put them together in a single marathon, and I went around the country presenting this marathon of studies. That resulted in several conversions and several new congregations, but it also left a need that we're working to address this year. That marathon to correct false ideas is kind of like somebody who buys a lot with an old house on it and tears the house down. You have to tear the house down if you want to build a new one. But you don't move in and live on the empty lot. Demolishing the old house is only the first step. Building the new house is critical for that. And so this year, I've been working and going back to some of the same places and intend to do this in several more yet in the second half of the year to follow up with studies in the Sermon on the Mount. And the purpose of this is to work on building the kind of character that's necessary if we're going to be disciples of Christ. It's not good enough to say I was wrong or they're wrong. We have to know what God wants and expects of us to be His disciples. In the next section, what I'd like to show you is a geographic progression over the years. And I want to take this in three-year increments. Each block up here is going to represent a place that Christians meet, whether it's one congregation or sometimes multiple congregations in the same area. This is not going to be a real precise thing, but it'll serve to visually have an idea of what's been happening over the years. In 1993, we moved to work in São Paulo. By the end of that year, one congregation began to meet, a very small group that later grew somewhat there in the center of São Paulo. By 1996, there had been some further expansion, both in São Paulo and surrounding areas. Another congregation started in the southern part of São Paulo, one more kind of between where those two were, and in the interior, or the backwoods. If it were New York, it would be upstate. But outside the main city, other congregations that were started in Indaiatuba and Mojimirim, where those groups continue to meet till this day. By 1999, the expansion was going out a little bit farther into other parts of the state of São Paulo and up into Bahia. Some of you have heard the story before about a dozen people who were baptized after we'd spent a few days in Jequié, in Bahia. That happened during this time period. By 2002, and I apologize for the poor color choice here, by 2002, there was some further expansion with another congregation that had started down in the São Paulo area in Santa Teresa. This is in the greater São Paulo area, but also up in João Pessoa, where a congregation began during that time that continues to thrive. This is kind of one wing of that congregation. They meet in a patio and garage or carport of a house where the corner of the house comes out between those two wings. So whoever's preaching is up in the corner looking to both sides, but they can't see the other people that are on the other side of that group. So this is about half of the congregation, one of the times we were there visiting them. João Pessoa is the easternmost city on the American mainland. Just so you all know, according to Brazilian schools, there are six continents, not seven. America is a single continent, not two. Of course, in Brazil, they also believe that cats have seven lives and that the Wright brothers did not invent the airplane, but those are other stories. At any rate, it is the easternmost point on the American continent. It's the closest to Africa that you can get without leaving the mainland. During that time, also another congregation in São Paulo, in Jordanópolis, is where they're now meeting. By 2005, a little bit further expansion, including a new congregation in Cotia, about an hour out from where we live in São Paulo. Now, I want you to kind of take a look. I'm going to back up here one more time. Forget about the picture down here and watch the map. As we go from 2005 to 2008, I started traveling much more extensively in the latter half of 2006, with a greater emphasis on trying to get out to where contacts were in other parts of the country. And so in the years from 2006 on, we've seen several opportunities, several new congregations. Ipatinga in Minas Gerais, the state to our north, a very small congregation there. Brasilia, the capital city of the country in the federal district, a congregation, a small but very active congregation now meeting there. Also, a congregation down in Porto Alegre in the southern part of the country, the southernmost state. We've had contact with different ones in that area over the years, but there's a solid group meeting there now. And up in Fortaleza on the northeastern coast, during the last several years, we've had opportunity to do a great deal of work up there. Three different congregations have been started over that period of time. Unfortunately, one of them strayed away completely. Well, I should say those who were controlling it strayed away completely. Several of the people left there to go and worship with one of the other groups. So there are now two congregations that I can recommend in the city of Fortaleza. By 2011, one more time, let me back this up. Watch the map. Forget the picture. Watch the map as we go from 2008 to 2011. Again, what we're seeing are these constant contacts through the internet, opportunities when we go out to these different places. As a result of that, conversions and new congregations. I don't do a very good job of keeping statistics on things like this. despite the lesson this evening about statistics. I'm not very good at keeping the numbers straight, but just to illustrate the idea, in the last year we've seen about 50 baptisms, and approximately 80% of those have been website contacts. There are now some congregations meeting in Brazil that every person in the congregation was initially a website contact. Benita and I made a trip to Rio, which is the second largest city in the country, just a couple months before this trip here. And after we'd studied with them all through the weekend, Sunday evening they had their regular assembly, the whole congregation and a couple of visitors there, about 10 people, 10 Christians, plus some visitors. And as we're getting ready to start, Benita asked me, now which ones of these were website contacts? So I looked around and answered her question, every single one of them. And that's not the only place that has happened, but it's encouraging to see. These are people that come from different directions, literally opposite sides of the city, opposite financial conditions. We've got everything from a man who lives in a fairly luxurious section of the southern part of the city to a young man who lives in one of the favelas, the Brazilian word for a slum, who was baptized that very day that we were there. It's encouraging to see so many who are looking out, and that has led to the start of congregations. There's an all-women's congregation up in Alagoas, not because they want it to be that way, but because so far no men have been converted in that city. I mentioned the time that there were 14 baptized on the same night. That has later led to opportunities, and there are now three congregations in the state of Sergipe. That's where Carl Ballard and his family moved when they returned to Brazil. I encouraged them to look hard at that area, and they are now working and giving their attention primarily to those brethren. These are some of the others from that same area, that same state. Manaus, the capital of the rainforest, has an active congregation of about 20 or so that are now meeting and serving the Lord there. One more thing I want to show here before we move on. When we talk about geography, it'd be great if in every city that somebody contacted us and we were able to go and teach and somebody obeyed the gospel, that there were 15 at one time, or even two. Because at least we could say, well, now the two of you can meet together and you will be a church. But sometimes it's just one. And that means sometimes some very difficult situations. I've put up a few of these little smiley faces to illustrate the reality of Christians who are isolated, sometimes several hours from other Christians. And I know on the map it looks pretty small, but remember, we're talking about states on average twice the size of the average state in the United States. I want to just tell you one story of one of these smiley faces. Oh, the one right up here in the northern part of Bahia represents a fellow named Romulo. In English, it would look more like Romulus. Romulo started corresponding with me a few months ago, and when I found out where he lived and what his situation was, I asked a Brazilian preacher who lives in the southern part of the same state if he could communicate with Romulo and try to work it out to get to where he was. Just a few days, maybe a week or so before making this trip, I got an email from that brother that said he had been able to work it out. He had made a bus trip of several hours to get to where Romulo lives, including the last couple of hours on dirt roads. Got there and found him in a rather difficult situation. It's a very poor, isolated village. Romulo lost one of his parents at age 3 and the other at age 12. He's being raised by an aunt. He is now 15 years old. And the brother who went to study with him was absolutely amazed at how much this young man has learned studying by himself. So much, in fact, that he was already asking all the right questions, and on the first day of their meeting, Romulo was baptized for the remission of his sins. But I want to tell you how Romulo has studied. He's a poor boy. He scrapes together coins to go to the equivalent of a cyber cafe where it probably costs about 75 cents an hour for him to use the internet. He doesn't have money to print things out that he gets off the internet, and at that point was not receiving things from us in the mail. We didn't know him that way. So he would take a notebook, and as he read articles, he would jot down every scripture reference that he came across and go home and study. And the brother that went to study with him was amazed at how much he had learned that way, how much he clearly understood in a city where the only church he knows about is a Catholic church, and where nobody else has shown interest that he knows about in doing the same thing. That got to me, quite frankly. But at the same time, Romulo represents to me kind of a perfect illustration of one who is diligently seeking God. which is what he demands of every single one of us. How many 15-year-olds do you know who would scrape together whatever money they're able to get a hold of to go study the Bible alone with no encouragement and support from anybody else around them, including his own aunt, does not encourage him in what he's doing? I don't know how the Lord's going to help Hoamalu. I hope that some of us will be able to help him to get there, to be able to help him. But I'm encouraged by examples of people like him. Just as it does in Madison, Alabama, the gospel has impact on the lives of people in Brazil. Sometimes it means broken marriage is restored. I told you about Vanderlei, the fellow that invited 40-some people or brought 40-some people to his house for a study. I want to tell you a little bit more of that story. The first time I met Vanderlei was when I was doing studies in Manaus, and he had been invited to come to them by his sister, who is a member of a denomination, and to this day, she's quite content where she is. She thinks she's fine. She was invited by an insurance salesman who at that time was serving the Lord and has since totally abandoned the Lord and his own wife. But Vanderlei came to the study. And when Vanderlei came to the study, he was recovering from a hangover. His marriage was on the rocks because of his drinking. His wife was just about to the point of saying, "It's over." After the first Bible study that Vanderlei participated in, he never put another drop of alcohol in his mouth. 2 months later, he and his wife were both baptized. Their marriage is back on solid ground. They've had another child since that time. And Vanderlei has proven to be about as zealous as anybody I know in evangelism, has made trips at his own expense to several other cities because he knows people there, relatives in other states, thousands of miles away, and he wants to go and tell them about the gospel. I'm thankful for the gospel that can have that kind of impact in the life of a man. Sometimes it means the illicit marriages have to come to an end. A brother in Rio who had already been married was together with a woman who had already been married. When he studied the gospel, he understood that he could not stay with her and serve the Lord, so he separated from her. Sometimes it means putting businesses and taxes in order. I've read that as many as 90% of Brazilians practice some form of tax evasion. So when one becomes a Christian, he has to change that. And in some cases, it means paying huge debts of back taxes, having to sell off properties to be able to do so. But that's what it means to serve the Lord. Sometimes it means closing businesses. A woman converted last year in Rio ran a dance studio in which she taught choreography and, by her own words, sensual dances to young ladies. When she obeyed the gospel, she realized she could no longer do that. So even though it was a successful and well-known dance studio, she closed it because she wants to serve the Lord. Sometimes it means giving up positions, sometimes even salaried positions in churches to be able to serve the Lord. And almost always it means learning to dress differently. The United States is not far behind. Last time I came up here was in the wintertime. I prefer that. But this time I'm here in the summertime, and you're not doing much better than they're doing down in Brazil these days as a nation. I certainly hope that you all are doing much better. But in Brazil, it often means teaching people how to dress because they think it's normal to use very little clothing. And as they learn to obey, to serve the Lord, that means putting clothes on. And as it does here and anywhere else in the world, serving the Lord means learning to stand alone for Him. Very briefly, some challenges that we've looked to. As I mentioned, we're coming up on 19 years. In a sense, we're coming to a second generation in our work in Brazil. And that brings with it the danger of some frustration at not seeing greater progress, greater growth, the danger of stagnation, of thinking, well, we've learned enough, we've done enough, we don't need to work so hard. We have to battle against those things. Constantly, we see a need for greater participation on the part of Brazilian brethren. Throughout the years that I've been in Brazil, I have not received support from Brazilian churches, but I've also not solicited church support from American churches for Brazilian preachers. I've encouraged Brazilian churches to support men they know and can communicate with in their own language and their own culture. And so we need to constantly be teaching on that and encouraging their support of Brazilian preachers. The Brazilian economy has improved rather dramatically over these last 19 years. It doesn't mean that the dollar does well against their currency, but it does mean that for the average Brazilian, things are much better financially than they were. The life is much, much easier in many ways. And that increase in prosperity in Brazil, just as in the United States, brings the great temptation to think, well, things are going pretty well. I don't really need God. And therefore, I believe that it will become more and more difficult to proclaim the gospel. There's so many reasons that we have to be thankful in the work in Brazil. The privilege, the blessing that Benita and I have had to stay there and devote the better part of our adult life so far to that work. Among those reasons, the many people who are receptive to the gospel, who are seeking truth. The privilege of sitting down to study with somebody who has already struggled to come to an understanding of God's word and who shows an eagerness to learn and to do what the scriptures teach. I'm thankful for zealous Brazilian brethren. We need more, but there are many who are dedicating themselves to that work of preaching and teaching the gospel. I'm thankful for the faithful support of North American brethren like you all over a long period of time. If I'm not mistaken, the congregation here has now supported me without interruption for 27 years in work in Michigan, Illinois, and now for the last almost 19 in Brazil. I like that kind of relationship, where it's not just a check in the mail, and it's not just a matter of occasionally or for a couple of years, but a long-term relationship where we're able to trust you as you have shown very clearly trust in us and the work that's being done there. And to be quite frank, I'm privileged, quite blessed, to be able to say something very similar about several other congregations that have been involved supporting us for a number of years. And 27 years sounds like a long time. The congregation here is in a tie for second place. There's one congregation up in West Virginia that has helped us every single month for the last 31 years. Benita and I have worked with churches where that were not able to support us fully or been in Brazil since 6 weeks after we got married in 1980. We have received outside support, at least part of our support, all that time. And there's one congregation in Brazil, or in West Virginia, that started supporting us when Benita was pregnant with our first child. She's now a grandmother to seven. I appreciate brethren like that who are willing to maintain long-term commitments in the work that's being done. And certainly, we must be thankful to God who gives the increase, who gives us together the privilege of being involved in efforts such as these that are being done in Brazil. Very briefly now, I want to tie this up with something of a spiritual application of a natural phenomenon that I consider quite interesting in Manaus. This is a picture not of just muddy water. This is actually a picture of the Amazon River just after the meeting of the Black River, or Rio Negro, and the Rio Solimões, the two rivers that meet by the city of Manaus to form what we know as the Amazon River. Those two rivers, when they come together, bring together water that's so different in its characteristics that it doesn't mix immediately. One side of the river, for about 7 miles, continues to be black water, while the other side of it is kind of a muddy-looking brown water. There are primarily three reasons for that: a difference in pH, a difference in speed, and a difference in temperature of the two rivers coming together. After about 7 miles, and if you look at a satellite picture like this one from Google Maps, after the meeting here, finally, about 7 miles downriver, finally the water kind of blends together and continues on several hundred more miles until it spills into the Atlantic Ocean. I kind of suspect that if Jesus had spent his time in Manaus instead of Capernaum, that there probably would have been some sort of a parable come out of the meeting of the waters. And I want to suggest very briefly some applications of a natural phenomenon that we see in that way. There's a separation that takes place just as we must recognize the need for a distinction between right and wrong in every aspect of our service to the Lord and our seeking of Him. Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, "Test all things, hold fast what is good, abstain from every form of evil." He demands of us that kind of a distinction, a separation. And that means a separation that must be maintained in our lives, that we are not to live participating in the things that God has not approved, those things that He has condemned. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14, the writer said, "Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord." Holiness means separation, or we might even think of it as a separateness from the things of the world. As Jesus said in John chapter 17, "We are in the world, but we are not to be of the world." He did not intend to take us out of the world. In fact, He sent His apostles into the world and sends us into the world. I mentioned there's some things that are really bad in Brazil. But we need to go to places like that because there are people who need the opportunity to come out of that mire of sin, of perversity, that would lead them to eternal destruction. Jesus said in John 17, starting in verse 15, I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. Jesus spoke of going into the world, but not being of the world. And we must maintain that clear distinction. We live in a society that is constantly preaching the idea of an ecumenical spirit of tolerance for all kinds of divergence. I believe we need to treat other people with respect and with kindness, but we need to be careful not to fool ourselves to believe that God will be tolerant of all kinds of divergence. When we diverge from His will, it is to our eternal peril. And there's the danger of losing that separateness, of blending in. After several miles, the water does blend together, eventually. After several miles, you can't tell the difference anymore between the two rivers because they have become one. And if we allow ourselves to walk with the world, to run with the world, to adapt our pace to the pace of the world, remember I mentioned one difference is the speed of flow of the water of the two rivers. If we allow our characteristics, our chemistry to become equal, the other difference, another difference, is the pH, the level of acidity of the waters. If we allow ourselves to get to the point that our zeal is tempered and we get to where we're the same temperature as the world in which we live, we'll lose our separateness, our holiness. Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lewdness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. We need to maintain a difference where our rate of flow will be different than those who walk beside us, where our temperature will be different, where our makeup will be different than those who walk beside us. There's also a flip side to this. It'd be possible to look at that meeting of the waters in Manaus and see a different lesson. Instead of looking at it from the standpoint of the separation, we could think about it that maybe the water that wins out 7 miles downstream from that meeting point is actually the right side. And that as it blends together, it's because of the influence of the good water to change the water that it has met. And certainly there's a teaching in that sense in what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, verse 16, Jesus said, Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. We know from this very same context that he expects us to be the light that will illuminate the world, that will change the world, that will overcome the darkness. He expects us to be the salt that will preserve the very world that would persecute us, that would seek to overcome and destroy us. He loved us, and we are to demonstrate the same love toward those that we seek to change, those that we have opportunity to meet. Two very distinct rivers meet. And I think there's some interesting lessons that can be drawn from that. As we close this evening, I want to thank each of you, and I want to thank the congregation here collectively for your role in what we're able to be doing in Brazil. It's a privilege to be able to have some small part in what God is doing in that country. We continue to pray that He will raise up more and more people, especially Brazilians, to be more involved in that work, to help to get the gospel out. On one side, we can be encouraged to see a certain progression and a spread and new congregations and other people converted in different parts of the country. On the other side, there is so much work yet to be done. And as we think in those terms, and I solicit your prayers, I want to bring that into perspective with just a couple of suggestions, a couple of points to consider. I'd like you to imagine a nation the size of the 48 states that you know in this country. We're leaving Alaska out of the picture. The size of these 48 states, in that nation, scattered about approximately 25 congregations where you would probably feel comfortable worshiping and serving the Lord. I'm not trying to judge all the churches in Brazil. Those are groups that I know of that I could recommend. And to help those brethren and to help in spreading the gospel to other areas, in that geographic area, five men supported to preach full-time. Two foreigners and three nationals. If that were the situation in the United States, would you pray fervently for God to help? That is the situation in the country that has become my home. It's a lot better than it was a few years ago, but there's a lot more to be done. Many more people who need the opportunity to hear the gospel. Please pray for that work, that more people can have that opportunity to hear the gospel. Thank you very much for your attention this evening.